Hello, I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. From feather-clad native peoples to exotic plants and animals, writes Neil Safir, Amazonia holds a unique place in the global imaginary. There is something so vast about the region that it defies our ability to grasp it fully. It eludes us. To understand it, we must become a part of it. Today, live in the CITR studio, I have the pleasure to speak with Professor Neil Safir about Amazonia. Neil Safir is an associate professor in the UBC Department of History. He has an extraordinary academic background, he speaks multiple languages, and his research focuses on such things such as the cross-cultural transmission of knowledge, narratives of cultural encounter between Europe and the non-European world, the history of cartography, and colonial Brazil, as well as the Amazon River region. He also has written a book called Measuring the New World, Enlightenment Science and South America. Neil, welcome to Prof Talk.
Thank you.
How does one begin a discussion on Amazonia, a region that is so incredibly vast and diverse?
Well, that's an excellent question. I should say, even before we begin the discussion of Amazonia, just one small correction. I'm still an assistant professor here at UBC, just in case, which I doubt very much, any of my colleagues happen to be listening to this interview. But I'm actually going up for tenure this year, so hopefully, with fingers crossed, next year. The idea of approaching Amazonia as one large system is something that it has always kind of baffled and boggled me as well, because Amazonia is really many different worlds that people tend to lump together as one larger unit. We certainly do when we think of the stereotypes of this great large place in the middle of South America that serves as a lung for the rest of the planet. And really, when I started doing research on Amazonia, I had that very question, which is, how did this broad place, this enormous place, come to be understood in the imagination of first Europeans, and then the people, as I went on, the people who actually lived there in the forest. So part of my research has to do with understanding how it is that we come to have ideas about places and peoples that are very far from us, through texts, through maps, through visual sources, and even through audio sources, to the extent that we can recapture them.
Now, sometimes the Amazon is called a continent. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting because actually early explorers thought of it as a very large island, in fact, connected by, at the southern end, the Rio de la Plata, a region that you may be somewhat familiar with, and at the other end, the Orinoco coming into the Amazon River. It was actually thought that at the confluence of those three rivers was located the Garden of Eden. And so from a very early stage, even in the 16th century, this idea that there was a space that was set off from the continent of South America and actually was a kind of a mythic continent in and of itself was born. Now I think the idea that it is a continent really stems from the fact that it is such a massive region and such a huge part of South America, really belonging to, or at least many countries think that it belongs to them, and there are at least 9 countries that that consider Amazonia, of approximately 13 in South America, that consider Amazonia a part of their heritage. So it really is continental in scale.
Now, is it because the river goes through all of those countries? What really defines the borders?
Well, there are many different ways, actually, to define Amazonia. One is just the Amazonian floodplain. That is to say, all of the rivers that eventually will arrive into the main course of the Amazon itself. As you know, the Amazon is actually three rivers, which it's the Marañón in on the western edge, the Solimões, which is called the Amazon, and then the Solimões and then the Amazon. So already you have these kinds of divisions within the larger geography of the Amazon that that speak to its diverse nature. But it also can be defined by cultural and environmental factors, so that the Guianas on the northern end edge of South America, even though their rivers do not drain into the Amazon, are very much considered culturally, geographically, and symbolically part of Amazonia.
Now, you're currently teaching an undergraduate course on the history of Amazonia. This is a first for UBC, but also perhaps something very new at any university. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, the idea to do a course on the history of Amazonia was something that that I had wanted to do for a long time. But I also came to realize that there were very few courses that very few courses, at least recently, that have been offered in Latin American history. But there were also very few courses on South America in particular. And I thought that it's interesting, rather than taking a kind of a national perspective, such as the history of Brazil or the history of Peru or the history of Mexico, what would happen, in a sense, if we tried to take this large region that covers so many different countries, that covers so much time, and try to write a history of it? Questions arise like, well, where do we actually start that history? Do we start with the arrival of Europeans? Do we start with the arrival of native populations who came over the Bering Strait? Do we start with the history of Brazil? All of these kinds of questions. So I think that it also, in addition to being an interesting topic, it also establishes very interesting questions about the art and craft of history that is a useful model for students to take away. Advanced students, it must be said, which most of the students in the class are third or fourth year.
Yeah. Now, so there's really a lot of challenges in teaching a course on the Amazon, and you've mentioned some of them, but I mean, really, how can you cover such a large amount of history in a 3-credit course?
By leaping and bounding over a lot of topics that deserve a lot more attention than we actually are able to give them. One of the ways that I do it is that I involve the students in the exploration of the Amazon. And I use explorations specifically here because I definitely feel like the students are, in many ways, like the earliest explorers of the Amazon, also going diving into the Amazon with me. And what I've asked the students to do is to choose different aspects of Amazonia. Some of them may know nothing about Amazonia, but they'll learn very quickly, and literally to dive in and explore, for instance, an indigenous group that they had heard of but didn't really know anything about, an explorer whose particular narrative is of interest to them, or any kind of other historical event. We have the advantage that there's a lot of very good popular literature, historical literature, written about the Amazon because it is this symbolic place. So I also ask students to review books that have been written recently about it that are that take a particular kind of angle and approach. So it's a very scattershot approach. This is not a political history, it's not a biological history, it's not an anthropological history, it's not an archaeological history. It's all of those things at once, and I think we lose something if we lose sight of that larger geographical and disciplinary whole.
Mm-hmm. Now, what first intrigued you to study this part of the world?
Well, that's an interesting question. It was actually a kind of a fortuitous life event that took me after I had applied to graduate school to study 18th century French cultural history. I was interested in musical culture during the French Revolution. But I had never been to South America, and I decided to take a trip prior to graduate school. And I ended up in Chilean Patagonia doing a kind of 9-day circuit in the Torres del Paine National Park. There I met four Brazilians who invited me to go back to Brazil with them to a city called Belo Horizonte in the state of Minas Gerais. And at the first moment that I stepped foot in Brazil, which was actually in the Iguazu Falls region, I knew that this place was going to change the way that I understood European history, and but also was going to kind of change the course of my own interests. And I became interested then in the experience of those first explorers who came to Brazil and South America and tried to understand what it was about that place that intrigued them, the tremendous biodiversity, the tremendous cultural resources, and I essentially was hooked from there. I must say, though, I really maintained my interest in the European side of things and have worked really hard to not consider myself either a Europeanist or a Latin Americanist, but to look for those connections between the different histories, points of common origin, of common understanding. And it's not always an easy thing to do, but it's really kind of the direction, moving toward a more global history and a history that can explain a lot of different functions outside of the angle of the nation state.
So did you spend some time in Brazil working on your PhD? Is that how you learned Portuguese?
Well, I learned Portuguese actually during the first 4 months when I was there. I grew up learning Spanish in California, and it was an opportunity to change accents and to change structures of the language, but I picked up Portuguese fairly quickly. I found it a very interesting and sonorous language, which I think helps. I loved the music, I loved the culture, I loved the people, and so I learned Portuguese really during that first experience. Then subsequently I would go back to Brazil, and actually, most of the archival resources for my dissertation were in Europe, not in in Brazil. But I have gone back. I've made a lot of connections with wonderful colleagues, other historians, but also anthropologists, archaeologists most recently. And so Brazil is part of my circuit, in a sense. And I feel it's necessary for me to go there on a fairly regular basis to keep up with the latest scholarship and the latest activities.
And now last month you were there in Manaus at a conference that looked at really the archaeology of the Amazon. Can you tell us about it?
Well, the archaeology of the Amazon is a field that really in the last 50 years, but especially in the last 20 years or so, has undergone tremendous growth and has become a really fascinating field. Even before my own interest in Amazonian archaeology, I was very interested in connecting the kinds of history that I study, which tend to be focused around the 18th century, with a much longer, deeper history of peoples who don't have the kinds of textual sources about them or written by them that we have for European explorers, for instance. So I was interested already in looking back across that sort of boundary that historians have of written sources to see what it was that we could glean about the way that people lived prior to the arrival of written language. I met a wonderful archaeologist from the University of São Paulo named Eduardo Neves, who is kind of the man for Amazonian archaeology nowadays, and he invited me to participate in the second international meeting of Amazonian archaeologists in Manaus earlier in September. Mm-hmm. And I went there and was absolutely astounded by the richness and the creativity of this burgeoning field. They have completely changed the way they thought about early Amazonian populations. They have discovered what they call kind of proto-cities in the Amazon, different kinds of technologies, causeways, sophisticated ways of dealing with the natural environment. This is no longer a a set of populations that see themselves as kind of nomads or merely hunter-gatherers. They were engaging and interacting with the environment and actually, some argue, affecting the biodiversity of the Amazon forest. So we shouldn't see this forest as a kind of pristine place that is untouched by human hands, but rather something that has always been interacted with and engaged with by human populations. Of course, there's a flip side of that, which is that some argue that that gives carte blanche to present-day interests who are essentially trying to take advantage of the Amazon and use up its resources very quickly. I think that's a gross exaggeration of the position. Just because a kind of scientific discovery may go against the sort of orientation of current politics doesn't mean we necessarily have to throw that interpretation out altogether.
Out of everything that you got from the conference, what was really the message that you left with?
Well, I think mostly the lesson for me as a historian was a methodological one, which was that really we are able to garner so much from other disciplines that we should not limit ourselves to only going to conferences that are, in a sense, going to reinforce the way that we already think about documents, the way that we already think about time periods. And I was the only historian, actually, of that entire conference, not just the sole gringo there. Actually, there were other gringos as well. But I thought it was really wonderful. It was a wonderful privilege for me to be there and to see the way that with very scanty sets of materials, a scratch there, a potsherd there, a kind of cave painting there, that archaeologists were trying really to piece together what the history, what the kind of interactions between native populations and their natural environment were like. And I thought that was just really awesome, and it's something that I certainly can use for my own work, which is putting together very disparate kinds of sources as well.
What are you working on right now?
Well, actually, just last night, I was finishing an article that I was asked to submit to the French journal, the Annal. I'm very hopeful that it will be accepted. It's a special issue on environmental history, in fact. And my contribution relates to how we can use material objects and the study of material culture to understand the relationship between human populations and the natural environment, especially in the 18th century. Looking also at the ways that naturalists, for instance, cataloged and listed the different kinds of objects that they found in the forest, and how that created different ideas that we have as far as what kinds of resources were available and still are available in the Amazon basin. So really going back to a time before they knew what could actually be cultivated, what could be distributed, what could be globalized, if you will, and understanding the technologies that were used for that. Not surprisingly, I also have a section in that paper where I talk about the deeper history of the Amazon, the discoveries that archaeologists have made recently, which drew very explicitly from my experience and conversation at that conference in Manaus. So it was a really wonderful opportunity to kind of, and I would say a lot more timely than is often the case with academic articles, where you can actually use things that you're working on and submit them in a very short order right after. So that we'll see if the article gets accepted.
I want to ask you about the languages you've studied and what you're also currently studying, what your next project is.
Well, I grew up in California, and public schools, and also I attended some private schools, one studies Spanish as a matter of course, although I also studied French early on. And I also worked in restaurants when I was in high school. So I had made friends with a lot of Mexicans who were also with me working in the as dishwashers or as busboys. And so from a very early stage, I saw Spanish as a living language, not someplace, not something that you could just sort of say, you know, I'd like a burrito, please. and then I started studying languages. Have always fascinated me, and I've always been interested in them. And I started studying French in at university, and after that, I also studied Italian because I had an earlier career idea of being an opera singer. That I studied voice and lyric opera for a while when I was living in New York, and we went to Italy for a couple of years, and I learned Italian there. And then finally came back around to Portuguese when I arrived in Brazil. I'm currently working on my German, which is, despite my mother having been born in Berlin, nicht so gut. I spent 2 months in Berlin at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in May and June, improved certain vocabulary words by living in Berlin. My ability to order beer in German has dramatically improved, but I'm hoping to be able to order other things the next time I go back there. So I'm sort of on the side, still working on my German currently.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, thank you, Neil, for joining us this afternoon. It was really great to talk to you.
Well, it's a real pleasure, and thank you for having me on the show.
For those of you who've just tuned in, you've been listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Neil Safir from the Department of History. If you'd like to learn more about his research, you can link to his website from the history webpage at www.ubc.ca. In 2 weeks' time, I speak with Dr. Marilyn Chapman, who is the lead researcher and the author of the new guide for full-day kindergarten in the province, as well as the director of the Institute for Early Childhood Education and Research in UBC's Faculty of Education. Now, if you'd like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, you can visit CITR.ca or check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. I'd like to end today's show with playing music from the album Aguas de Amazonia by a group called
Wakichi. And if I could just say one thing very quickly, the group Wakichi is actually, there's an Amazonian concept behind the name. It was a myth of a creature that had holes in its body that terrorized women, actually, in the forest. And the sound of the wind going through these holes actually created a kind of music. And you can hear very clearly on this piece of music, as well as others, that they're very inspired by instruments that have very particular kinds of almost windy sorts of sounds. So this is a kind of a fusion with Philip Glass of some sounds from the Amazon as interpreted by one of Brazil's really leading instrumental groups.
And the name of the river of this song?
This is the river Japura, which is a tributary of the Amazon River.
Well, with that, thank you, Neil. I'm Farah Khan. Thank you for listening to Prof Talk this afternoon. Talk to you in 2 weeks.